You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Consider the end. No one knows candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s problematic history better than his family. Joe Hagan talks to that reluctant inner circle about Kennedy's past and the stakes for America's future. And the listener should realize that this article went to press before the presidential elections. Opening photo, cheaper by the dozen. Ethel and Robert F. Kennedy Sr. with nine of their children in 1966. 20 years ago, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. appeared in an HBO documentary about the dangers of a nuclear plant on the Hudson River. Indian Point, Imagining the Unimaginable, directed by his sister Rory Kennedy, pits the crusading Kennedys, pictured flying in a helicopter over the nuclear facility, against Entergy, the power company. The film argued that the surrounding environment would be made uninhabitable if the plant came under terrorist attack. This was necessarily a high-stakes confrontation. In anticipation, Rory warned her production team they had a potential liability. Her brother, though a prominent and successful environmental lawyer known for suing polluters, could be fast and loose with the facts. "He can say some crazy shit," she told them, according to a person involved in the film. Kennedy's interviews had to be thoroughly fact-checked, even though he might come across as an expert, she said. "That's who he is." Sure enough, the film had already been edited when producers discovered that Kennedy's interviews were littered with inflated and inaccurate claims, rendering portions of the film unusable. "It was like, holy shit," says another source familiar with events. "We have to get the audio and cut certain things out. We can't really say this. You can be sued." The experience of having to tear the film apart and re-edit it was deeply frustrating for Rory, especially because HBO had wanted more Bobby, not less. When her brother gave a speech at the film's premiere, wowed audience members asked Rory why she hadn't included some of his more dramatic points in her film. She couldn't tell them it was because they were untrue. Long before he entered the 2024 race with a wagon train of conspiracy theories, the wider Kennedy family was intimately familiar with RFK Jr.'s problematic personality, the outsized confidence masquerading as expertise, the savior complex, as one family member called it, that drives him to take up quixotic causes and cast himself as a lone hero against established powers, and, above all, as one old friend calls it, his pathological need for attention. A few months ago, I began talking to Kennedy family members and close friends, some on the record, others on background, to get insights into the man they know well and to ask some pointed questions. Rather than merely rubber-stamping President Joe Biden's already fatally faltering campaign, shouldn't you be telling voters what you know about your brother and cousin, whose candidacy threatens to swing the presidential election to Donald Trump and upend American history forever? With the future of the country riding on the narrowest of polling margins, shouldn't you be describing in fine detail the acute dangers of the person you know so well, before your own family's tragedy becomes the nation's? To describe the family as reluctant is an understatement. Behind the scenes, his siblings, especially brothers Max, Chris, and Joseph II, are furious over his candidacy. Sisters Carrie and Rory are heartbroken. But the desire to preserve their relationship with their brother, combined with the long-standing Kennedy blood oath to protect the family reputation, as someone close to the family described their loyalty, has prevented them from pulling back the curtain on the RFK Jr. they know, instead choosing to focus on policy differences. The Kennedy campaign did not respond to detailed questions from Vanity Fair. After initially denouncing his candidacy last summer, most of the 105 Kennedy relatives, including Bobby's 8 siblings, the largest branch of the family, had hoped his campaign would collapse under the weight of his many bizarre claims and alliances with anti-vax cranks and Trump world figures like Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson. Instead, the family has played defense, going public only when Kennedy's statements went so far out of bounds they had no choice. Like when he suggested COVID was ethnically targeted to spare Jewish and Chinese people, or his claim that anti-vaxxers suffered worse oppression than Anne Frank, a statement Sister Carrie called sickening and destructive, or when he claimed there was a mysterious alternative shooter in the death of his father in 1968, going so far as to interview Sirhan B. Sirhan in prison and proclaim him innocent, or that the CIA was possibly involved in the assassination, claims that caused deep pain for his siblings. Their private efforts to get Bobby to drop out, or at least wait until 2028 to run, have also come to naught. I've spoken to Bobby about this race, about what's at stake, about the importance of supporting Joe Biden, of the impact of the Trump presidency on our country and on the world. Carrie Kennedy, who leads the nonprofit Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights and is disciplined in how she speaks of her brother, tells me, and I was clearly unpersuasive. Asked to share insight into her brother's motives and psychology, she begs off. Well, you need to have a degree, which I don't have. Loyalty has always been the highest virtue in a family that has lived for decades under the public microscope. Stories of Ethel Kennedy keeping ancient friends in her social orbit for favors performed decades earlier are legend. Speaking out is verboten. But the genteel approach has made it easy for RFK Jr. to dismiss them, and even to suggest there is a sizable faction of supporters in their ranks, though in truth only one other cousin, Anthony Shriver, has publicly backed him. When 50 Kennedy family members, including the branch known as Generation 3, or G3, appeared on the lawn of the White House with Biden on St. Patrick's Day of last year, it was supposed to be a powerful show of solidarity. But the event was a compromise among people who didn't necessarily agree about what to do, says a person involved. A month later, a public event in Philadelphia generated a series of choreographed videos of the cousins voicing support for Biden. But it had no discernible effect on RFK Jr.'s polling numbers, even as the cousins, to prove their strategy was working, clung to a single poll showing Kennedy would take more votes from Trump than Biden. Other pollsters like John Della Volpe at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School say the opposite. Since then, Kennedy has managed to get his name on the ballot in the swing state of Michigan and is spending millions in other states to do the same. A few Kennedy cousins have pushed for a more aggressive approach, with one mockingly referring to the White House photo op as the leprechaun event. Behind the scenes, there is a growing panic that the family must do more to prevent their rogue cousin from causing a political disaster, especially in the wake of Biden's debate performance. As one family intimate, Andy Karsh, who has known Kennedy since 1972, has put it to Bobby directly, "If Trump is elected, You'll go down as one of the great villains in American history. Bobby risked damaging the legacies of both his father and uncle at a time when those values and ideals could not be any more important, Karsh tells me. The portrait family members paint of Bobby is of a man of exceptional charm, wit, brains, and generosity, who has championed important environmental causes, but whose worst traits, an unnerving ease with blending fact and fiction, a powerful ability to deny the collateral damage of his own destructive actions, have engulfed his better angels. The source of these pathologies, they observe, are found in his long and troubling biography, a life story marked by personal trauma and addiction to drugs, sex, and, perhaps most perniciously of all, public adulation. You can't reason with addiction, says Stephen Kennedy Smith, a cousin of Kennedy's whose father ran the elder Bobby Kennedy's 1968 presidential campaign. And what we know about addiction is it leads to bad judgment, extremely bad judgment. Next photo, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Michael Kennedy, and Joseph Kennedy II attend Jeff Rue and Courtney Kennedy's wedding in 1980. Last year, Robert Kennedy Jr. texted a photograph to a friend. In the photo, RFK Jr. was posing alongside an unidentified woman with the barbecued remains of what he suggested to the friend was a dog. Kennedy told the person, who was traveling to Asia, that he might enjoy a restaurant in Korea that served dog on the menu, suggesting Kennedy had sampled dog. The photo was taken in 2010, according to the digital file's metadata, the same year he was diagnosed with a dead tapeworm in his brain. The picture's intent seems to have been comedic. Kennedy and his companion are pantomiming, but for the recipient, it was disturbing evidence of Kennedy's poor judgment and thoughtlessness, simultaneously mocking Korean culture, reveling in animal cruelty, and needlessly risking his reputation and that of his family. Though he did not respond to Vanity Fair, after this story was published online, Kennedy said publicly that the picture is of a goat in Patagonia, contrary to what he texted his friend, and has deployed a GOAT meme. Kennedy later told Snopes.com it was a lamb, not a goat. The friend says that Kennedy sent me the picture with a recommendation to visit the best dog restaurant in Seoul, so he was certainly representing that this was a dog and not a goat. In any case, it's grotesque. When Kennedy was married to his second wife, Mary Richardson, he was known to text other damning images to friends as well, of nude women. Those friends assumed Kennedy himself had taken the pictures, but they didn't know whether the subjects had consented to having their genitalia photographed, let alone shared with other people. When one friend lost his phone, he panicked that somebody might discover the images. Theories about Kennedy's reckless behaviors abound. Long before it was reported, members of the family knew about the brain worm, which in court testimonies Kennedy conjectured he'd picked up from food he ate in South Asia. He said the tapeworm consumed a portion of his brain and led to protracted brain fog. But more often, his family points to Kennedy's 14 years as a heroin user, which began when Kennedy was 15 and didn't end until he was 29. Kennedy has made his history of addiction part of his campaign narrative, arguing that he is more equipped to fix America's addiction problem. Critics in his family feel otherwise. One Kennedy has circulated a report from the National Institutes of Health on the impact of long-term heroin abuse, which surmises that the damage can alter the physiology of the brain, creating long-term imbalances in neuronal and hormonal systems that are not easily reversed, and which may affect decision-making abilities, the ability to regulate behavior and responses to stressful situations. At Harvard in the mid-1970s, Kennedy was regularly injecting speedballs, a mixture of heroin and cocaine, and became a Pied Piper to friends and family, regularly shooting up with his troubled brother David Kennedy, according to multiple friends from the era. Addiction shadowed RFK Jr. and his entourage, including his best friend Chris Bartle, through college and law school, and into his early professional life working in the Manhattan DA's office. On one level, Kennedy's substance abuse was comprehensible. He had seen his own father murdered on the public stage, a traumatic event that altered history, haunted his family, and deepened the weight of expectation on young Bobby, who was 14 at the time. Of all Bobby Sr.'s children, the namesake son was considered the most promising dynastic heir. Square-jawed and twinkly-eyed, he looked and sounded the most like his father. With the charisma and public profile to take up the mantle if he chose. His college roommate, Peter Kaplan, the acclaimed editor of the New York Observer, who died in 2013, once noted Bobby's almost frightening facility with language. By birthright and training, Kennedy was presidential timber, with family friends like Robert Coles, a psychiatrist and professor at Harvard, and Lem Billings, a close friend of John F. Kennedy's, expending considerable effort trying to mentor and tutor him after his father's death. Jack Kennedy was lucky, Billings once said. He didn't have a lot of Kennedys getting there before him. Everywhere a boy like Bobby looks, there are footprints, all of them deeper than his own. Many tried and failed to get him off heroin. Instead of guiding him to greater glory, Billings followed Bobby into heroin addiction. Meantime, Kennedy looked for heroes outside the family bubble, befriending Roger Ailes, the late Fox News founder, who at the time was an independent TV producer and advisor to Richard Nixon. In 1972, when RFK Jr. was 18, Ailes took Kennedy to Kenya to shoot a wildlife documentary, in which Kennedy appeared shirtless and running from a rhinoceros. Family lore had it that Kennedy, while attending Harvard, once leapt the gap between two six-story buildings. He kept an owl in his house and carried a live snake around campus. Because of the drug-taking and risky behavior, Bobby was often at odds with his mother, Ethel, who regularly threw him out of the house. Jackie Kennedy Onassis forbade her own children, John and Caroline, from fraternizing with him and his brothers. Like all the rest of us, Bobby grew up feeling that being a Kennedy, you could do virtually anything you wanted. Kennedy's cousin Chris Lawford told the authors of The Kennedys, An American Drama, a controversial 1984 book. It was good because you got away with things other people wouldn't dream of. It was bad because it destroyed your sense of what was worth doing. One of the authors, the other died in 2019, could attest to that. David Horowitz remembers Bobby being so cavalier that he cut lines of cocaine for his brother Michael Kennedy and allowed him to snort a line in front of the writer, and only then did he introduce Horowitz as a reporter. Horowitz also recalls that Kennedy asked him for a ride to Harlem to score drugs. In 1983, RFK Jr., by then an assistant DA in the office of Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau, was discovered overdosing in the bathroom of an airplane. With an excerpt of the Kennedy book was published in Playboy magazine in 1984, the family turned on David Kennedy for airing the family's addiction secrets, and he stayed in a separate hotel during a family gathering in Palm Beach. Bobby, David had told the book's authors, was our last illusion. The next day, David died of an overdose at age 28. After Kennedy was arrested for possession of heroin, his cousin Michael Skakel, also a recovering addict, supported him through recovery, which Kennedy said brought them close together. He would say he knew Skakel as well as one person can know another. Skakel later became the chief suspect in the 1975 murder of 15-year-old Martha Moxley in Greenwich, Connecticut. Having confessed to private investigators in the mid-1990s that on the night of the murder, he had climbed a tree near Moxley's bedroom window and masturbated. She was found the next day beaten and stabbed to death with a broken golf club. Though he was not initially a suspect, Skakel had also intimated to boarding school's friends that he had committed the murder. By the late 1990s, Kennedy had found his calling as an environmental lawyer, running the nonprofit Riverkeeper, starting an environmental law firm, and leading the charge against corporate polluters, pressuring General Electric to spend $1.7 billion to clean up PCBs the company had dumped into the Hudson River. He regularly attended AA meetings, a model of recovery and renewed purpose. The other Kennedy men of his generation, however, were busy blowing up the family's legacy. Cousin William Kennedy Smith was tried for and acquitted of rape in a highly publicized 1991 trial. Brother Michael Kennedy's relationship with an underage babysitter was exposed before he died in a skiing accident in Aspen in 1997. Older brother Joseph II bowed out of a race for governor of Massachusetts after his ex-wife wrote a damaging tell-all in 1997. And then cousin John F. Kennedy, Jr., who was considered the quintessential Kennedy of his generation, died in a plane crash off Martha's Vineyard in 1999. When Greenwich authorities reopened the Moxley murder case in 1998 and later charged Skakel, the Kennedy family publicly distanced themselves from Skakel, who had previously worked as a driver for cousin Michael Kennedy, then running his brother Joseph Kennedy II's power company, Citizens Energy, while Joseph ran for governor of Massachusetts. People believed the angry Skakel leaked the story of Michael Kennedy and the babysitter to the Boston Globe, which blew up Michael Kennedy's career and marriage. Skakel's lawyer did not respond to Vanity Fair's questions for this story. The same year, Skakel circulated a book proposal to New York publishers for a memoir titled Dead Man Talking, A Kennedy Cousin Comes Clean, which promised to lay bare the devious workings of a propaganda machine that works night and day to hide the sordid truth behind a scrim of patriotic idealism, hero worship, and religiosity. The Kennedy family, he claimed, had accused him of trying to extort money from them. Skakel painted a portrait of Bobby and his brothers as rutting satyrs and alleged that Michael Kennedy had a three-way tryst with his secretary and his brother Bobby's wife. When Skakel went on trial for murder in 2002, RFK Jr. blamed Vanity Fair columnist Dominic Dunn for helping reopen the Moxley case by publishing a thinly veiled fictional account of the murder in 1993 called A Season in Purgatory, which seemed to implicate a Skakel family member. Around the same time, Skakel's father hired a private investigation firm. Their report, later acquired by Dunn, cast suspicion on Michael Skakel. Dunn and Kennedy engaged in a heated public feud over the facts of the case, trading volleys in published articles, including Kennedy's 14,000-word defense of Skakel in the Atlantic magazine. In an interview at the time, Kennedy accused Dunn of twisting the facts and using suggestive language to make his arguments appear more credible. "He's very clever about the way he does it. If you look at how he couches his accusations, it's always somebody told me this, an anonymous source said this. So he's not saying it's true, but the average reader misses that nuance. For some reason, the voice of this pathetic creature has been amplified by the willingness of talk show host to allow him on to spout this stuff, and by his publishers, who publish stuff without fact-checking." Bobby was the only Kennedy to defend Skakel, showing up twice to the Connecticut courtroom. Theories abound about why Kennedy felt compelled to defend Skakel, including speculation that Skakel was blackmailing him. According to one of Kennedy's diaries, obtained by the New York Post, he thought that his cousin was delusional and paranoid, even as he publicly maintained that Skakel was innocent of the murder. For his part, Dunn drew a pointed conclusion from Kennedy's defense. If you were to take Kennedy's word that he knows his cousin as much as any human being alive, he wrote, and you believe Skakel murdered a girl at 15, the concluding logic isn't so great for Bobby. Skakel had served 11 years of a 20-year sentence when, after years of appeals, arguing that his lawyer had botched the defense, the conviction was vacated, and Skakel was released pending a retrial. Prosecutors opted not to bring it again. In 2016, Kennedy published a book defending Skakel called Framed, Why Michael Skakel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit. Kennedy pinned the murder of Martha Moxley on two teenagers from New York City, one black, the other multiracial, whom investigators had already discounted. Ghostwritten by reporter Andrew Goldman and published by Skyhorse Publishing, which also issues Kennedy's anti-vaccine books, Kennedy's book claimed to have solved the murder. I am dead certain they did it, Kennedy told the New York Times. Both men have denied committing the murder. Asked about Kennedy's conclusions, Moxley's mother, Dorothy, said she had never seen the truth so twisted and manipulated in my entire life. Kennedy concluded that his claims were controversial. Anytime you do anything controversial, you lose constituents, he told the Times. You lose support because people have opinions. The book, hyped by Alan Dershowitz, also a Skyhorse author, and Bill O'Reilly, further buttressed Kennedy's identity as a serial white knight, jousted with the prevailing establishment, whether it's the justice system, corporate polluters, or the pharmaceutical industry, or later, Biden, the Democratic National Committee, and his own family. In 1994, Kennedy married Richardson, who had been Carrie Kennedy's best friend since they attended Putney School in Vermont together. She and Bobby had four children, Connor, Kira, Aiden, and Finn. In fall 1998, the Kennedys hired a 23-year-old woman, Eliza Cooney, as their part-time babysitter. She was a recent college graduate interested in working on environmental causes and had looked after Carrie's and Max's children in Hyannisport that summer. Cooney moved into Bobby and Mary's family home in Mount Kisco, New York, taking care of the kids and assisting Bobby at his environmental law clinic at Pace University during the week. One night, Cooney attended a meeting in the family kitchen with Kennedy and another young riverkeeper volunteer named Murray Fisher to discuss business when she felt Kennedy's hand moving up and down her leg under the table. She tried making sense of the incident in her diary, which I have read. In an entry dated November 7th, 1998, she wrote, "From everything everybody says about the Kennedys, plus their babysitters, they had me worried. Like, I have to watch out. Be careful. And the other night in the kitchen with Murray, I could have sworn he was touching my leg and hand. It seemed like he thought I was somebody else or he wasn't paying attention. Like he would come to every once in a while and snap out of it, or I would move away. It was like he was on something or really tired or was missing Mary or was testing me. In the back of my mind, I was hoping it wasn't what it actually was," says Cooney, now 48. Reached for comment, Fisher says he worked closely with Cooney and liked her, but wasn't aware of her alleged experiences with Kennedy at the time and feels bad for her. Weeks later, she discovered Kennedy standing in her bedroom. She saw that her diary, which chronicled her daily activities and detailed her romantic life with a boyfriend, was open next to her bed, and she was shocked when a shirtless Kennedy then 45, ask her to rub lotion on his back. I thought, isn't Mary home? She recalls. Doesn't she do this for you? She did it reluctantly and quickly. It was totally inappropriate, she says, adding that she stopped recording these experiences in her journal, fearing Kennedy would read them. A few months later, Cooney says, she was rifling through the Kennedy pantry for lunch after a yoga class, still in her sports bra and leggings, when Kennedy came up behind her, blocked her inside the room, and began groping her, putting his hands on her hips and sliding them up along her rib cage and breast. My back was to the door of the pantry, and he came up behind me, she says, describing the alleged sexual assault. I was frozen, shocked. He was interrupted by a worker who entered the kitchen. To announce his presence, the man, according to Cooney, said something like, "Don't do anything I wouldn't do," or "Don't do anything you wouldn't want your wife to know about." Cooney stayed on the job for a few more months, but says the experience damaged her confidence and diverted her from environmental work. Next photo, Kennedy with family and supporters as he announced his presidential candidacy in 2023. At the end of her diary, Cooney wrote a list of things to leave behind in 1999, with bad men at the top. After this story was published online, Kennedy told the Breaking Points podcast in response to Cooney's allegations that he is not a church boy. I have so many skeletons in my closet. When pressed to respond directly to her claims, he told the anchor, I'm not going to comment on it. Cooney kept these incidents secret until the hashtag MeToo movement began in 2017 when she first told her mother, Holly. Was I horrified? Of course. Was I surprised? Not really. And not because of the Kennedy name, as much as knowing what the culture was, especially in the world of privilege, Holly Cooney told me. I remember when we talked about it the first time, she was agonizing over how public she felt she was ready to go. In spring 2023, after Kennedy announced he was running against Biden for the Democratic nomination, she told two close friends and a lawyer, Elizabeth Geddes, who had prosecuted the rapper R. Kelly. Geddes suggested Cooney could still bring a civil suit against Kennedy under the Adult Survivors Act, but Cooney ultimately decided against it. His candidacy for president impelled her to share her story publicly now. In 2010, RFK Jr. began a relationship with actor Cheryl Hines of Curb Your Enthusiasm fame and separated from Richardson. Richardson had been enthralled by the Kennedys since childhood, and her identity was bound up in the marriage, even as it became an unbearable burden. She fell into alcoholism and depression. According to a new book called Ask Not, The Kennedys and the Women They Destroyed by Maureen Callahan, when Richardson found evidence of one of Kennedy's affairs, she became so hysterical that she'd run out of the house, gotten in her car, backed out of the driveway, and accidentally run over and killed Portia, the family dog. According to Callahan's reporting, Kennedy asked Richardson's therapist to diagnose her as mentally ill, but the therapist, who spoke to Callahan for the book, declined. After Kennedy left her, Richardson proposed she live in the guest house, while Kennedy and Hines lived in the main house, and that she keep the Kennedy name. He declined, and then tried to avoid paying her child support, using his brain fog as a medical excuse for alleged financial straits. Richardson, her behavior increasingly erratic, eventually lost custody of the children to Kennedy. The Kennedy family, including Carrie, who had once been like a sister to Richardson, began to distance themselves from her. On May 16, 2012, Richardson's housekeeper discovered Richardson hanging from the rafters in the barn. After her death, a sex diary from 2001 that Kennedy kept leaked to the New York Post. According to reporter Isabel Vincent, the back page listed the names of 24 women Kennedy had been involved with, including a scorecard of how far he got with each woman. Kennedy reportedly described himself as plagued by my lust demons and spoke of being mugged by women who came on to him or responded to his advances, meaning he was somehow targeted by women with whom he had affairs. He once recorded that he was mugged by two women at once. Kennedy told the Post, "I have no diary from 2001. Kennedy's family and friends weren't surprised. As a former friend of Richardson's recounted to me, Mary says to me, 'Poor Bobby, he's a sex addict. He's taking medication. It's so hard for him.' That's how sweet this woman was. 'My husband is a sex addict. My poor husband, he's sick.'" Riffing on Nora Ephron's famous quote about her ex-husband, Carl Bernstein, he was capable of having sex with a Venetian blind, Kennedy's friends would joke, "It's safe to say he would sleep with an Ottoman." One longtime friend had warned him that he needed to be more discreet. "Listen, I'm not being in any way judgmental," this person told him, "but you have to rein it in. Everybody in New York has a story." Kennedy insisted that he'd been faithful to his wife and appeared to believe what he was saying. "That was the scary part," the friend told me. "He really was pathologically involved with that narrative." The Richardson family has never forgiven Kennedy, privately maintaining that his boorish and insensitive behavior was a factor in Mary's death, hiring an investigative firm to explore a possible wrongful death suit against him, and accusing Kennedy of psychological torture. The Kennedys blamed Richardson's depression. Carrie remained loyal to Bobby, who had Richardson's remains buried on a Kennedy family plot against the wishes of the Richardsons. Against this backdrop, the tragic deaths of cousins and brothers, the Michael Skakel case, Richardson's suicide, the leaked sex diary, the new marriage to Hines, Kennedy was beginning to discover the cause that would consume him for the next 20 years. His work at Waterkeeper, the environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting waterways and drinking water, distinct from Riverkeeper, had centered around mercury levels found in migratory fish. When Connor, his first son by Richardson, suffered from allergies to peanuts and soy, Kennedy went looking for answers and found a suspect, mercury. He told Cooney, the babysitter who also worked at Kennedy's environmental project, that Connor's allergies were likely because of the shots he got when he was a baby, because they had mercury in them. By his own telling, Kennedy met mothers around this time who insisted he read research, alleging that autism is caused by mercury in the MMR vaccine. The idea of vaccines causing autism had just entered the mainstream after Andrew Wakefield, a British doctor, published a 4,000-word paper in the medical journal The Lancet, attempting to link vaccines to autism in children. His 1998 claim, simultaneously speculative and sweeping, became a cause célèbre in Hollywood circles, fanned by actors Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey. Oprah Winfrey publicized their claims on her TV show. It was just the kind of cause Kennedy was attracted to, counter to prevailing wisdom, with a huge payoff in heroism and public glory. His friend Jan Winner, founder and publisher of Rolling Stone, agreed, along with the editors of Salon, to co-publish a story Kennedy wrote about vaccines, which echoed Wakefield's research. It took 5 years for Wakefield's research to be debunked, and The Lancet to retract his paper, which prompted Rolling Stone and Salon to pull Kennedy's story in 2011. By then, however, the damage had been done, and Kennedy was now linked with a fellow anti-vax crusader named Del Bigtree, a former TV producer with no scientific background or medical training. Bigtree, who had been a producer on a TV show called The Doctors, began cultivating a following through books and TV appearances and held anti-vax rallies in places where skepticism was already strong. like in Hasidic Jewish communities. In the next few years, Kennedy and Big Tree would both appear publicly with Wakefield, publishing books of unfounded conspiracies and trolling CDC officials at public events, haranguing Anthony Fauci, the leading immunologist for the government. Kennedy was still the highest profile member of his enormous family, feted in Hollywood for his environmental activism. Starting in the late 00s, he was having regular conversations with Bill Clinton, who revered Kennedy's father. Clinton considered the son the de facto figurehead of the family and attended events memorializing the anniversary of Kennedy Sr.'s assassination and the rechristening of the Triborough Bridge as the Robert F. Kennedy Bridge. Clinton viewed him as the family emissary, says a Clinton World insider. For years, Kennedy's inner circle of friends, like Kaplan and Karsh, had stoked his lifelong political aspirations, but most of his old allies gave up hope. Kennedy had too many demons, too complicated a past. In 2014, Kennedy married Hines in a wedding attended by a glittering array of friends, including Larry David and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and moved to Los Angeles. The move marked a reinvention of sorts, distancing Kennedy from his East Coast network and perhaps removing some of the built-in guardrails that had tempered his worst impulses. In addition to consulting for companies seeking his environmental seal of approval, he chaired the 501c3 nonprofit Children's Health Defense, which began in 2007 under the name World Mercury Project, and inveighed against vaccines and fluoride in the water. During this period, figures like Alex Jones, Glenn Beck, and Donald Trump mainstreamed conspiracy culture, with Trump seeding his 2016 presidential run by hyping the racist conspiracy theory that President Barack Obama had faked his birth certificate and was a secret Muslim born in Kenya. Kennedy, having pushed discredited anti-vaccine views for over a decade, saw an opening. When Trump was elected president in November 2016, Kennedy secured an audience with him at Trump Tower. Friends warned Kennedy not to take the meeting, concerned he would end up like Mitt Romney, whose attempt to curry favor with Trump over dinner left Romney publicly humiliated. When Kennedy emerged from Trump Tower in January 2017, he claimed to the press that Trump had asked him to chair a commission on vaccine safety and scientific integrity. That same day, Trump advisor Hope Hicks said the two talked about autism, but Trump didn't commit to a commission on vaccines. Kennedy's meeting with Trump was the inflection point that broke his relationship with Riverkeeper, the nonprofit for which he was the chief prosecuting attorney and the public face. For years, the board and staff had been engaged in an uncomfortable internal debate about whether a science-based group like theirs should be led by a man making anti-scientific claims about vaccines and who, for good measure, opposed eco-friendly wind-powered turbines off Hyannisport that happened to mar his family's ocean views. His allies at other environmental groups, like the Natural Resources Defense Council, had already had similar conversations and parted ways with Kennedy over the vaccine issue in 2014. On Monday morning, he's giving a speech saying, "Do not believe any scientist on vaccines," recalls a person with close ties to Riverkeeper. And on Tuesday, "You've got to believe the scientist when it comes to climate change or what we're doing to the river." The Trump meeting spurred a revolt inside the nonprofit, with employees threatening to quit en masse if Kennedy wasn't ousted. In a series of meetings between Kennedy and his board, they agreed to treat Kennedy's exit from Riverkeeper as a resignation and not a firing, though in fact he was pressured to leave. With each public and private rejection, whether the retraction of his Rolling Stone article or his breakups with environmental groups, Kennedy dug in deeper and deeper. Increasingly, His anti-vaccine work was taking precedence. In 2018, Kennedy involved himself in a largely forgotten vaccine controversy in Samoa. That year, two children died after receiving the MMR vaccine, sparking a furor in the island nation. Though it was later revealed that two nurses made a critical error administering the vaccines, accidentally introducing expired muscle relaxants into the formula, Kennedy's nonprofit took to social media to hype the deaths as evidence of vaccine dangers. Under public pressure, the Samoan Prime Minister, Tuilapi Saleli Malegoe, halted MMR vaccines nationwide. In June 2019, Kennedy and Hines flew to Samoa, lending celebrity wattage to local anti-vax advocates, giving press interviews, and taking a private meeting with the PM. Over the ensuing months, Samoa was hit by the largest measles outbreak in its history, infecting 5,707 citizens and killing 83 people, most of them children. The outbreak was so lethal, the Prime Minister declared a state of emergency and ordered mandatory vaccinations, eventually curtailing the spread. Later, one of Kennedy's biggest critics, a pediatrician and member of the FDA's Advisory Committee on Vaccines, Paul Offit, told PBS that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had everything to do with that, and that shows you how disinformation can kill. In an interview with filmmaker Scott Hamilton Kennedy, no relation, who made a documentary called Shot in the Arm, which will appear on PBS this fall, RFK Jr. becomes vividly agitated when confronted with the facts of the Samoa case, insisting that, "I had nothing to do with people not vaccinating in Samoa. I never told anybody not to vaccinate." He had met with the Prime Minister to discuss implementing a medical system that would, in Kennedy's own words, measure health outcomes following the natural experiment created by the National Respite from Vaccines. In November 2019, Kennedy sent a letter to the Prime Minister, obtained by Scott Kennedy and shared with Vanity Fair, speculating that the measles outbreak might be attributed to the vaccine itself. Clearly caught off guard, Kennedy asked the filmmaker to let him approve the footage of their interview. The director refused. Scott Kennedy has since shown the documentary to RFK Jr.'s sister Rory Kennedy. She declined to comment to Vanity Fair. The year after the Samoa episode, the COVID pandemic began, ultimately killing millions of people. But it was a stroke of political and financial fortune for Kennedy, who found a ripe audience for his anti-vaccine claims, tapping into a newly fertile online world of misinformation, conspiracy, and distrust of pharmaceutical companies on podcast and social media. High-profile podcasters like Joe Rogan allowed him to spout his conspiracy theories unchecked, and Kennedy built a following among pseudoscientists and self-styled influencers, hawking supplements and alternative medicines under the banner of wellness, aligning with figures like Aubrey Marcus, a podcaster, poet, and self-styled guru of total human optimization, who hosted a fundraiser for Kennedy in Austin last March. The man had met his time. During the next 3 years, Kennedy would publish a half dozen books on the dangers of vaccines, co-star in a documentary with Andrew Wakefield, Vaxxed 2, The People's Truth, and launch a full-scale assault on Anthony Fauci, disseminating misinformation to an anti-vaccine movement that politicized health measures meant to protect the public from COVID, which led to untold numbers of unvaccinated people dying unnecessarily. Consequently, money poured into the tax-exempt Children's Health Defense, doubling revenue in 2020 to $6.8 million and increasing Kennedy's annual salary to $510,515 in 2022 from $40,200 in 2016. Kennedy's Twitter feed and that of Children's Health Defense grew to hundreds of thousands of followers. When Meta shut down his Instagram account after Kennedy disseminated misinformation on vaccines at the height of the COVID pandemic, Kennedy was enraged and sued the Biden administration, which he accused of pressuring Meta, turning the First Amendment into a pillar of his broader crusade and eventual campaign for president. As one family member put it to me, blocking access to his social media audience was like taking his stash. Last summer, during an interview with Vanity Fair, Kennedy told me the Biden administration lost me 800,000 followers. The suit is still pending. When Kennedy emerged as a candidate for president in April 2023, his body and face had become transfigured by what he has called a regimen of organic testosterone. Kennedy showed off his unusually puffy body in campaign workouts, going shirtless in an infamous push-up video. "I mean, he's unrecognizable," says a family intimate who has known him for decades. "It's like a body-snatching thing." His campaign also became pumped up, powered by cash infusions from his vice presidential pick, Nicole Shanahan, the ex-wife of Google co-founder Sergey Brin, and from Timothy Mellon, an heir to the Mellon banking fortune, who has given $30 million to the super PAC supporting Kennedy, while also giving $50 million to Trump's campaign, an alignment of interest that critics suspect is strategic, financing Kennedy's campaign to draw votes from Biden and thereby boost Trump. Many in Kennedy's family believe that their cousin's pursuit of the presidency has left him vulnerable, not only to the draw of his followers and the conspiracies he's employed to attract them, but to the influence of enablers in his own inner circle, including Big Tree, his stalwart fellow anti-vax crusader, who now serves as his campaign's director of communications and has drawn down $265,000 through a campaign-aligned LLC. His campaign manager is his own daughter-in-law, Amaryllis Fox, a former CIA agent and wife of Bobby III, himself an actor and screenwriter, who once ran a website dedicated to fact-checking political statements. The two met at Burning Man. Fox, 43, took over for Dennis Kucinich last October and has since been paid $223,000. Fox had no previous experience in campaigns, unless you count her acting role as a campaign manager in Fear and Loathing in Aspen, a 2021 film based on Hunter S. Thompson's quixotic run for sheriff in 1970, written and directed by Bobby III. The role was originally intended for his sister, Kick Kennedy. Fox published a 2019 memoir detailing her career as an undercover CIA agent, which she publicized before getting agency approval. The book includes a story of Fox meeting with Al-Qaeda-linked groups and averting a nuclear bomb detonation. Apple bought the television rights before it was even published. Fox told NBC News that she had altered aspects of her story and created composite characters to protect national security. Perhaps the most influential figure in Kennedy's orbit is Jay Carson, who worked as an aide to Bill Clinton when Clinton and Kennedy were friends and neighbors in Westchester County. Disenchanted with politics, Carson moved to Los Angeles and reinvented himself, becoming a producer for House of Cards and creating the series The Morning Show. After divorcing his first wife, producer Sarah Treem, creator of The Affair, he befriended Kennedy in an AA meeting and during the pandemic became a COVID lockdown skeptic. He got remarried to a self-described journey designer in Topanga Canyon, started attending a high-end survivalist school in Utah, whose clients also include Lachlan Murdoch and Drew Barrymore, and became a close advisor to Kennedy. The Kennedy family crest is inscribed with the French phrase, Avise la fin, meaning consider the end. It is a call to purpose turned dire warning. The Kennedy legacy was built on the idealism of John F. Kennedy and his brother Bobby, whose assassinations made them martyrs for the dream of liberal progress. In the ensuing decades, that dream became freighted with gossip, scandal, tragedy, and infamy, the so-called Kennedy curse, but has remained deeply resonant nonetheless, especially among Democrats. 56 years after the death of Robert F. Kennedy, the stage belongs to Bobby Jr., even as he has morphed into something closer to Donald Trump than anything related to his father or uncle, cultivating power like Trump has by sowing distrust and peddling misinformation and the listener must realize that this article went to press before the presidential election. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.